So today's speaker is Professor Hitesh Chengalani from Magna Lab in Florida, also Florida State University. So Hitesh got his PhD at Cornell. Were you the last student of Chris Henry?
Yeah, there was one after me, actually.
I see. You're not the last then, okay.
I was not the last, I was one of the last, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chris was a fantastic theorist, of course, right? So anyway, yeah, so after that, he was a postdoctoral fellow at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Then he also spent some time at Johns Hopkins. Then he moved to Florida State as an assistant professor. I think he moved there 2018. Yeah, okay. So Hitesh is an expert in physics of flux and magnet. And not surprisingly, he was a student of Chris Henry. But at the same time, he's a world expert in modern numerical simulations. So he made a lot of important contribution to that area. So I believe today's talk is also related to some of these numerical works. I think that's that. So Hitesh, please go ahead. And
thank you, Yongbek, so much for the kind introduction and very generous introduction, I would say. And thank you to the organizers, all the organizers who invited me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor. I was just looking at the speaker list and I was like, okay, the bar is really high. I have to do a good job. So let's hope I can do justice to the invitation. And this work is based on searching for quantum spin liquids, which many in the audience may not need any introduction, but I'm still going to give some slightly pedagogical overview in highly frustrated magnetic materials. And this work was initiated when I was at Johns Hopkins, but I've continued it on. There have been new materials since I arrived here. So a lot of the techniques were probably that we developed earlier or we implemented earlier, but a lot of the applications are pretty new. I'd like to thank my funding agency, NSF, and I'd like to thank Florida State University for very generous resources. And if you're really interested in this subject matter, those are some papers that we have worked on and that we are working on. I might not get to advertise, but I'm also venturing into other areas of frustrated magnetism. So if someone is interested, we can talk about it later. Okay, so what is this talk about? Well, this talk is mainly about, as I said, quantum spin liquids. It's a very, very vast topic. It's not possible to do a real justice to everyone working in this field, but I will focus on two sets of studies analyzing spin liquid candidates on pyrochlore magnets. And there are many experts in the audience, including the chair in this particular area. So let's hope I can say something new there. But along the way, I will try to emphasize some general lessons we have learned about simulating dynamics in these magnetic materials, especially at intermediate energies, and the techniques that we found useful. The two materials that I'm going to talk about are the spin, a near ideal realization of a spin one Heisenberg pyrochlore, and a possible still remains to be seen, still needs some more evidence, but a possible pi flux spin liquid state in a spin orbit coupled recently found pyrochlore magnet. And I'll explain what is so special about this particular finding. Now, one theme that occurs frequently in my work, which I hope I can emphasize to the audience, is that in both sets of studies, it was extremely important for us to look at all sorts of experiments very, very carefully and to get the effective Hamiltonian right. I'll emphasize this in a couple of slides. In general, this is a very long-standing problem, and even beyond the class of materials that I'm considering here, like doing a very thorough job looking at experiments is not an easy task. Okay, so who did I do this work with? Well, a lot of people to thank, but the people who really got things working were Kemp Plum, who did the experiments on the spin one pyrochlore, and Alan Shea, under, of course, the expert guidance of Colin Brougham and Bob Kaba. And the second paper, the later paper, was with theorists, Oleg and Roderick and Susie, who did actually a lot of the numerical calculations as well. And then part two, which is the cerium zirconate compound that I'm going to be telling about, some of the usual suspects from the previous project also made it to this project. But I must really say that without my postdoc Anish Bhardwaj, this would really not be possible. And with very, very, very important input by Andrei Nevidomsky and Han Yan at Rice. And I've been blessed to have some very great collaborators over many years. And I'd just like to thank all of them. I'd like to take the opportunity to do that. Okay, so physics of frustrated systems. And many experts in the audience, but let me give you some overview of what's happening in the systems. So let's take one of the favorite lattices, one of our favorite lattices, which we worked on for quite some time, the Kagome lattice. And let's say we switch off quantum mechanics. Say, okay, quantum mechanics is too hard. Let's just think about this problem classically. Well, it turns out that if you want to minimize the energy of the system, so you take the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, one of the simplest that you can realize. But by no means is that enough for actual real materials. But let's say we take the Heisenberg Hamiltonian and we say, okay, we just minimize the sum of three spins because we've forgotten quantum mechanics. And turns out that that can be done in infinitely many ways in the thermodynamic limit. And a simple way to see that, or a sort of pedagogical way to see that, is that all you need to satisfy is a 120 degree rule of three classical vectors on every triangle. You need one red, one blue, and one green, where the red, blue, and green are sort of classical vectors. And you tile your lattice a certain way. Two particular ways that I'm going to be telling, or that I'm showing here is Q equal to zero and root three by root three. Q equal to zero has just a magnetic unit cell of three sides that repeats. You see all the up triangles are red, blue, green, red, blue, green, red, blue, green. And you take root three by root three, that has a bigger unit cell. It's a nine-site unit cell. But the important thing I want you to focus on is that if you look at the two color loops, you look at red, blue, red, blue, red, blue here, or you look at red, blue here, and you decide to swap the colors, you make red, blue, and blue, red locally, they are shielded by the greens. So if you rotate the two color loops, or you say I swap the two colors of the two loops, of the respective loops, I'm still in this manifold. I'm still in the three coloring manifold. And in fact, these are not the only two sort of families of solutions you can make. You can actually make exponentially many such solutions. Baxter calculated the exact number in the 1970s on the honeycomb lattice, which is dual to this lattice. So, you know, this is a hard problem. I mean, classically it's a simple problem, but then you can ask, okay, now I want to introduce quantum mechanics. Well, okay, then things get really, really difficult. And sort of this is the gist of, or this is the spirit of what happens. I think there's a question in the chat, so I'm just curious if I should take that or wait. I can't see the current slide. Oops. Can everyone see my slide? Yongwek, somebody said that they cannot see my slide.
I can see your slide.
I can see the slide too, no problem.
It's fine here.
Okay. Okay, sorry. So the spirit of this frustration, or the fact that there are exponentially many colorings in that case, or the fact that there are exponentially many ways of writing down classical ground states, is by no means limited to the Kagome lattice. It also transfers to the pyrochlore lattice, which, okay, you know, the Kagome still makes its entry into the pyrochlore, because if you look at pyrochlore along the 1-1-1 axis, it looks like Kagome triangle stacked a certain way. But let's not worry about that. Let's worry about this different lattice, which is the pyrochlore lattice, which is now in three dimensions. And now you have a different rule. You don't have this three coloring rule, okay? But you have a different kind of frustration. You have a two in, two out rule, because the Hamiltonian is not quite Heisenberg. Now the spins are constrained to be along a local 1-1-1 axis. So it's either pointing locally inwards or locally outwards. And if you look at the sign of the Hamiltonian, you might say, oh, it's just ferromagnetic interactions. How am I getting something which sounds anti-ferromagnetic, two in, two out? I'll get to that in a second. But all I want to tell you is that, assume if it was anti-ferromagnetic and two in, two out, well, then you actually can see what is called the Pauling entropy, which means you cool down the sample and you go all the way to low temperature and you ask, okay, what is the integral of the specific heat divided by temperature, that gives me the entropy. Well, you actually see the residual entropy. So just in case you were worrying about the sign of the interactions, well, actually, the bare interactions are ferromagnetic, but the angle these director vector makes with respect to each other give you a cosine theta of, which is equal to minus 1/3. So that gives you another minus sign. So that's effectively in the Ising, in terms of the Ising variables, you have anti-ferromagnetic interactions. Now you can say, oh, I want to go beyond the ice manifold. I don't want to just restrict myself to the low energy physics. Well, maybe that's just, okay, no constraint, fine, great. But now I introduce some sort of quantum fluctuations, or let's say even if I introduce thermal fluctuations where I flip a spin. Well, this is a theme that occurs frequently in condensed matter physics. When you flip a spin, now you can introduce not only one defect tetrahedron, you introduce two defect tetrahedrons. And this sort of model was realized by many people, including, you know, sort of pursued by Castelnuovo, Meusner, and Sondi in a very famous paper. You introduce two defect tetrahedrons, where now you violate this ice rule locally on two tetrahedra. But actually, there is no energy cost, at least within the nearest neighbor models, there is no energy cost for dragging these defect triangles far apart. And the energy cost for dragging these apart is actually zero. And these two defect triangles, these two defect tetrahedra basically act like monopoles. You've injected one unit of angular momentum into the system, but then you drag these things apart at no energy cost. Well, that's, you know, so that's like you fractionalized the one unit of angular momentum that you put into the system. It turns out that there's more to this story, which I will not get into, but it will become a little bit relevant a little later, is that these defect tetrahedron, they act like magnetic monopoles. And if you imagine the coarse-grained theory of this pyrochlore antiferromagnet, you can actually map it to electromagnetism, which is described by U1 gauge theory. We'll get to that a little bit later, or at least I'll mention it in passing later. Okay, so that's all classical. And we've already seen some hints of quantum mechanics can do interesting things because quantum mechanics can create excitations. But what we want is we want the ground state to be a superposition of many quantum mechanical configurations. So if we have something like order by disorder, or we have some sort of interaction which lifts this degeneracy, well, then we are back to choosing some conventional state. But if you can make a superposition of these ice configurations or these competing states, well, that makes the problem really interesting. And many people, including Linus Pauling, thought about this. Anderson really extended these ideas to an extended lattice. But Linus Pauling was thinking about these on benzene molecules. And the new sort of modern understanding that we have of spin liquids is that these phases are described very much by the entanglement property. The fact that they have fractionalized excitations, I already give you a cartoon for this. And initially it was believed that spin liquid is some phase that there's no symmetry breaking of any kind, but that definition has been relaxed considerably over many years. But where we come in, where I come in, or where my group comes in, is that we want to go beyond this cartoon realization, which of course are very important to drive research in this field. We want to think about realistic materials and models that can actually realize such a phase. And okay, so that's where we come. So what lessons did we learn when we were growing up in this field is that you take the most realistic model, the model that I showed you earlier, the Heisenberg model for just Kagome, you know, which is highly, highly frustrated. And you do state-of-the-art numerics, and I'm summarizing 30 years of work on one slide, so of course I'm not going to be doing justice to everyone. But you can see that if you look at the energy per site of various candidate phases versus the system size, so if you go to the left on that plot, you're going towards the thermodynamic limit. If you go to the right, you're going to smaller and smaller clusters. There are many competing phases, all of which apparently look all unrelated to each other. You have a Marsden-Zeng valence bond solid, which was also studied by Central, and you have a spin liquid, which was sort of proposed by Subir Sachdev and White-Elzer in the 90s. They all compete with each other, and it's a very, very small energy scale that you're dealing with in this problem. So if you put your material scientist hat on, you say, okay, maybe this is too idealistic, but I still want to resolve these small energy scales. You need a resolution, if assuming J of around 200 Kelvin, which I think is reasonable, a resolution of around 0.1 millielectron volt per atom. And that's a very tiny energy scale. So if you say, okay, I'm just going to use something like BFT or something like that, it's going to be challenging to say, okay, I found a spin liquid of some sort, because that's not the accuracy of the theory. So you can say, okay, I'm going to make a phase diagram. I'm going to do my best. I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to solve some lattice model, and I'm going to do it as accurately as I can. And even that turns out to be very challenging, as I just showed you on the previous slide. But we and many others have invested time, and we have some sort of tentative phase diagram, because it has limitations, finite size, and so on. You can say, okay, I'm going to make a generalized phase diagram. I'm not going to be restricted very much to the Heisenberg point, because maybe that is not too material specific. Maybe the search space is bigger. And I sort of map out a phase diagram, a realistic one, and do my best, the best I can. I use numerics and so on. And then, okay, so what do I do with this phase diagram? So then the next very natural question that arises is, where is the real material on this phase diagram? So now I don't want to belabor the point. I think I made my point that the frustration is very, very important towards even this material search and so on. And I would like to just acknowledge work on Kitai model materials that is being done in Yong Beck's group and Heyang Ki's group and many other groups. And I'm going to be focusing on lattices with frustration. And every rule that you see here kind of can be broken. For example, you can say, okay, I'm going to do, you know, spin one. Maybe spin one is not too quantum. You know, it's maybe spin one is more in the classical regime. And it turns out that every rule that you want to impose actually can be broken. So you want to sort of extend the search space beyond what you conventionally think as, oh, this is quantum and this is classical, because the boundary may not be as sharp as we think it is. So that's the direction, that's the strategy that we took. That we first said, okay, maybe we'll try for a spin one system. We were basically a little bit perturbed by looking at all the work in searches for spin liquids. Here I'm emphasizing something that was done for alpha ruthenium trichloride, which of course has a long history. I mean, many Canadian groups have been involved. We were really disheartened to see this kind of table, where even after many, many years of work, trying to fit a Kitaev Heisenberg model to alpha ruthenium trichloride gave couplings all over the place. Maybe this is being resolved now, but this is a real, real challenge. I mean, it's already challenging to definitively determine the properties of the lattice model. It's even harder to sort of say what the material parameters are, or it's equally hard. So we want to do as much as we can. We want to fit as much data as we can, or we want to sort of employ, we want to use as many theoretical techniques as we can to sort of answer this question of, have we found a spin liquid, or where in the phase diagram are we? Okay, so we won't go over this very extensively. We talk to neutron scatterers, and we basically model what is S of Q omega. There's a lot of information in S of Q omega. So we're not just looking at the ground state, but also looking at dynamics. And of course, the techniques that we have to do 3D dynamics are limited, but I'll briefly mention what we've been using. So it becomes the evaluation of some sort of correlator like that, and looking at the data very, very carefully. What should we expect? So if you have sort of magnons, which are conventional quasi-particles, then you expect spin waves. But if you have these spin-ons, you have fractionalized excitations, you expect a continuum of excitations. Now, just because you see a continuum, that doesn't mean that you necessarily have spin-ons. It can be all sorts of other effects like disorder and so on. But at least it's promising, at least and coupled with other metrics, at least it looks promising that this could be a viable, if you see something like a continuum in neutron scattering, it's at least viable that this could be some sort of possibility for a spin liquid. So this is where we come in, and we do our musings. We're thinking about things. We're saying, okay, wow, Haldane had some really brilliant idea for spin one chain. he basically explicitly also AKLT fractionalized spin one into spin half degrees of freedom. And great. And he found all these sorts of edge modes and no exponentially decaying correlation functions. And so we started to think, what would happen on the cargo? And actually we wrote down, inspired by Hida, we actually just took his variational wave function and found that it actually does better than what he thought it did. He just calculated the energy. And it was variationally superior to all sorts of other more simplistic candidates that were out there, like root 3 by root 3 state and the trimerized wave function. But this is where we had to do some state-of-the-art numerics like BMRG to actually resolve the question. And it turns out that this particular state wins. So we had some hunch for a spin liquid, but some sort of fractionalized state where the spin 1 degrees of freedom were getting fractionalized. But unlike the spin 1 chain, these spin half degrees of freedom now don't form a singlet on just a bond. They form a singlet around a loop of 6 spins. Okay, so that didn't quite work. Okay, so what next? So go to 3 dimensions. And in 3 dimensions, Chong Wang and others were thinking in this direction as well on the diamond lattice. And there's some nice work by Yasir Iqbal, came a little bit after our experimental paper, arguing that within what is called functional renormalization group, which is one of the few techniques that can be applied to 3 dimensions with some success, showed something paramagnetic, but they cannot really be confident that it's spin liquid, but it's something that does not magnetically order. And we also looked at some earlier papers by Ueda and Sigrist, which were also trying to use these AKLT ideas, but they didn't really consider the case of just the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. They were putting all sorts of additional interactions to try to understand what happens for the spin one case. So that's where actually the experiment comes in. The experimental discovery came before V theorists had an idea what's going on. And I would say, still say that the quantum theory for the spin one pyrochlore is still unresolved. I mean, there's still not much theory out there. But if you look at this particular material, which is NCNF, that's the short form I'll use, you look at the specific heat versus temperature, the specific heat just has a bump at around 20 to 30 Kelvin, which turns out to be the scale of the Heisenberg interaction, which is J, around 20 to 30 Kelvin or 3 MeV. And you look at the structure, it's pyrochlore, of course, but the nickel is the magnetic ion, and nickel is in 2+ state. So this is just some, so roughly the extent of my own knowledge of chemistry, but the nickel is surrounded by an octahedral cage. And so there is a G3-2G splitting, and nickel 2+ is D8. Remember, copper 2+ is D9. You're very familiar with that from the cuprates, but nickel 2+ is D8. Just fill it all up. You're left with 2 unpaired electrons because of Hund's rule. They want to be sort of aligned with each other. And there's not strong spin orbit coupling. So this basically acts effectively like a spin 1 degree of freedom on a pyrochlore lattice. What else did they see? Well, they did elastic neutron scattering, also inelastic, of course, but they did the elastic. They did not see any evidence of drag peaks. They also did some, I mean Kemp Plum primarily and collaborators. So we joined in after all this theoretical data was available, after all this data was, experimental data was available. But they didn't see any real scaling with the temperature. So drag peaks didn't really, there were no drag peaks and there were no features that became sort of sharper with temperature. The lowest temperature with which they did neutron scattering was 1.6 Kelvin. And remember, J is 30 Kelvin. So it's still, it's well past that bump that I showed you. It's somewhere in this region that it did the neutron scattering. So it's not technically zero temperature, but sure, I mean, quantum effects probably should be important in that regime. You can actually see that very easily. We just fit a classical Heisenberg model to the high temperature data, and that gave us the scale of J. Sure enough, that J turned out to be 30 Kelvin. But okay, I mean, what do we do next? We don't have only the Heisenberg J, because it turns out that the Heisenberg J, if you calculate its correlation functions, you calculate its neutron neutron signal, that's insufficient to describe the data. I'll show you the data in a minute. So we need a more sophisticated Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian that we used is that of dipoles, interacting dipoles, spins. They act like dipoles. They will soon start to act like multipoles. I'll explain that in a minute. But for interacting dipole moments on a pyroclore lattice, there are significant constraints on what the interactions can be by all sorts of symmetries, constrained by all sorts of symmetries. And that was worked out in several papers. Most prominently, we saw the work of Gollin, and we got excited and went into this direction, which was on a different pyroclore, ytterbium titanate. But anyway, so we basically took these interaction matrices, and these interaction matrices are characterized by four parameters. And so you can morally think of J1 as sort of XY and J2 as the Ising interaction. And one becomes you have the pseudo-dipolar and you have the DM interaction. So we took all these interaction parameters, four interaction parameters, but we also needed one more. So we took the Heisenberg-like next nearest neighbor. And we found using a technique that, unfortunately, I will not go into the details of that technique, but it's called the self-consistent Gaussian approximation. It's a large N approximation where evaluation of the correlation functions becomes simple. You can basically just do Gaussian integrals. I might mention it depending on how much time I have. Okay, I seem to have time. Okay, but using the self-consistent Gaussian approximation, we could estimate the parameters by fitting all sorts of neutron data. And I will tell you what that fitting looked like. So in the interest of time, I will skip the SCGA, but I'm more than happy to visit it for anyone who's interested. So we fit all sorts of neutron data.
So what are the question?
Yeah, say that again. It's all classical. But look, you need a lot of momentum resolution to fit all this neutron data, right? And you're right, it's completely classical. So in some sense, very simple to do, actually. But if you do all these classical Monte Carlo, then fitting becomes expensive because you just have to do a lot of parameter sets. And so, yes, it's all classical. And you basically make the spin length large. You say spin length is large. So it's like a large N theory. But then you basically have to put a Lagrange multiplier to put a constraint that will actually, on average, the spin length has to be one. In this case, for NCNF, we did a spin half system, or you put spin length of half. So you have to put a constraint, but the advantage is that the Gaussian integrals become easy to evaluate. And okay, then you have a closed form analytic expression for the correlation functions. And right, so the way it was developed in Conlon and Chalker was for, you know, rotationally symmetric Heisenberg Hamiltonians, but my collaborator Xu Zhang actually beautifully has implemented it and generalized it for even anisotropic interactions. It's actually extremely valuable technique because we don't have to go to finite field to fit all sorts of spin wave dispersions, etc., like Bruce and collaborators were doing in some beautiful work by Kate Ross. This is all zero field data that we are fitting. And in zero field, we have both the spin flip channel and we have the non-spin flip channel. We have multiple cross sections. So we have, you just have to get used to thinking about it. So you remember you have S of Q omega. So you have three dimensions of Q and one dimension of omega. So you have four dimensions. Well, that's too much, too much to fit. So what you do is you basically take the integrated structure factor. So that gives you, that just gives you S of Q, so integrate over energy. And so you just fit the static correlations to SCGA. And to believe that you are not doing something totally nonsensical, you basically verify it with Monte Carlo calculations. Now, of course, SCGA should be taken with a grain of salt because it works only for where you have a sort of paramagnetic sort of phase. If you had some order tendency to order or something, or if you had an ordered state, this technique would completely fail. So we were lucky that there was no ordering going on. But if there was some order going on, yeah, well, then we are left with no other option but not to use that thing. Sorry, is there a question?
Quick question. So I mean, you could just do a classical Monte Carlo for this.
Yeah, that's what we did here as well.
So then why do you need a self-consistent Gaussian?
We don't, it's just much faster. What takes seconds versus minutes or hours?
Okay.
Yeah, you just have to do, it's, you don't need it. You, as I said, you don't need it. It's just there. It works consistently with the Monte Carlo.
Okay, so, I got you. Yeah.
We did both, right? So that's good. Okay. So now we go to dynamics, because as I said, I don't care only about the static correlations. I care about dynamics. Once again, as Strong was saying, this is all classical. The only quantum mechanical method we have in all of this, or semi-classical, semi-quantum, is linear spin wave theory. And let me start off with the left. From the left, we have Monte Carlo plus Landau-Lifshitz dynamics. So we just basically say, okay, how does the spin process in the field experienced from all its neighbors, or next nearest neighbors in this case, just write down the evolution equation. It's very straightforward. You solve it with Runge-Kutta methods and so on. Then there is another technique, which is sort of more phenomenological. You write down a hydrodynamic equation for how these spins evolve with time. But hey, how do you put temperature in all of this? Well, you model it with a random kick. That's the so-called stochastic large end theory with Chalker et al. Did. And then there's linear spin wave theory. And you might say, what is so innovative about this? Well, we are doing spin wave theory in real space, and we're not doing it about one ordered configuration. Rather, we're doing it about many configurations that we encounter in the Monte Carlo as sort of metastable minima. And we sort of average it. We average their spectra. We average their neutron signal, S of Q omega. So of course, none of these techniques are really telling us if we have a coherent superposition of, you know, the ones that I introduced earlier. And I will comment on that pretty soon. Anyway, so this is the technology for this part of the project. And I will, in the interest of time, I will skip the subtleties with all of this, but I will just tell you the result. Yes, even though it is classical, it gives us the momentum distributions in various cross sections now as a function of energy. So earlier I just showed you the integrated structure factor. Now I'm showing you several cross sections, and the several cross sections also work remarkably well with molecular dynamics, appropriately rescaled, because of course we're doing classical and we want to go to quantum. So yeah, we need to introduce a rescaling factor, but the rescaling factor doesn't change the momentum distribution at all. All it changes is the energy distribution in a significant way, but it does. Whereas if you look at the stochastic large end theory, that really doesn't capture, I mean, it captures the pinch points at low energy, but as you go to higher and higher energy, and you go to on a scale of omega, which is the neutron transfer omega, transfer energy on a scale of J, well, then you lose notion of the fact that, oh, you need to satisfy this constraint condition that the sum of four spins has to be zero on a tetrahedron. So you lose that. Whereas the molecular dynamics and the linear spin wave theory capture that reasonably well. You see, the bar is much lower than what you would have to, you know, get the low, you know, ground state energy of the Heisenberg. That's a hard problem. But this is just to explain things in experiment. And the agreement is remarkably good, remarkably nice, except at low energies, which I'm going to talk about soon. Bruce raised his hand. So yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Actually, it might be that you're just about to talk about this, but as you know, this system on the A side is very disordered, right? The sodium, calcium.
Yes.
And
I'm not going to comment on that. I'm going to just show you a slide that says that there needs to be more that needs to be done in that direction, because you do see in the susceptibility, you do see some sort of glassiness, you do see some sort of hysteresis. And so you're right, it could be that we are seeing something glassy, and that we are sort of, but each of these glassy configurations is sort of in this, not ice, but in the sort of, zero energy, whatever, this four spin zero sort of constrained manifold. And what we are seeing is sort of, it could be that we're seeing the signal from sort of these coexisting domains. That is not an impossibility, because we don't have that quantum theory which says, oh, this is a superposition and you'll go and calculate it. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I was going to leave that as a future further remark. Maybe I'll come back that later, Bruce, if that's okay.
Sure. Yeah. No problem. Yeah. Thank you.
So, all I want to say is that you capture these characteristic pinch points very beautifully in these dynamical simulations. You also see that the energy dependence is turning out to be remarkably well captured. So that was one cross-section. Now I'm showing you another cross-section. Once again, the molecular dynamics rescaled appropriately is capturing lots of things. Now you can say, oh, here it broke down, but actually the overall intensity has gone down remarkably in the neutron itself. It's very difficult to see any real structures here at this point. Well, you can say, oh, you just cheated all this time because you told us that quantum mechanics is important for fractionalization. And sure it is, there's no denying that. But look, we are looking at intermediate energy scales. If we go down to very, very low energy, there's no way, there's no escaping the fact that you need quantum mechanics. You'll just be doing classical mechanics. But for many problems, for many systems, there seems to be a correspondence between classical dynamics and quantum dynamics, which I would say we sort of accidentally discovered, but actually other people have been speculating about that as well. So you can say, oh, I don't want to do this messy problem, to do some sort of clean problem. Yeah, go ahead, do the Kitaev problem, which is what Battista and collaborators did. And there the quantum and classical sort of neutron signals, where you can sort of write down the structure factor exactly, dynamical structure factor exactly, shows a remarkable correspondence. So maybe we rediscovered something that maybe someone else knew in some other system, but it's there, is what we see. So of course, if you go down to very, now I'm showing you the energy versus a one-dimensional momentum cut. And of course, yeah, if you go down to very, very low energy, see that it's not so great. It's not, doesn't work so awesomely well. But if you look at intermediate energies, it's not maybe so important to have all sorts of fractionalized quasi particles in the theory. Other descriptions could also explain that part of the signal. I don't like color plots, so I'm going to show you one more plot where we actually took the experimental data as a function of energy for different specific momentum points. The circles are experiment, and the dashed red and the solid red are theory. As I said, I have to rescale. The linear spin wave theory doesn't have to be rescaled, but molecular dynamics does. It's a classical method. And you can see that at intermediate energies, the agreement is reasonable. Actually playing with raw data, I mean, I just did not believe that this can be true. But at low energies, which is the omega on the scale of J, remember that is 30 Kelvin or 3 MeV, start to see differences. And maybe that is not too shocking. Okay, so we were sort of happy that we got this to work, and okay, we applied it to other systems. I won't talk about this in the interest of time. I want to get to the main topic or the second main project, which is the cerium zirconate compound, because there seems to be some interest. And so this is answering Bruce's point. Yeah, if you look at the susceptibility, there is some hysteresis, which would mean that it's all glassy. And so the natural question, is there a spin-liquid coexistence with some disorder? There's also the specific heat scaling we don't understand, which is T square. And we saw some paper by Podolsky and Kim Yong, the same Kim Yong, but Kim. So maybe we can chat about this. I'm not a real expert in those directions, but these remain some unresolved puzzles in this direction. Let me move to the next compound, because I wanted to use the first compound as a foray of the techniques that we have. They are, you know, it can be implemented straightforward, but okay, you have to look at the experimental data carefully. And so here comes Bruce, and he produced data that was intriguing to us. The backstory is that in 2019, I had already moved out of Hopkins, but I briefly spoke to Gaudet, and I was like, okay, this sounds really interesting. And parallelly, Andrei Nevidomsky at Rice was basically working closely with Pengcheng Dai. So two groups basically produced the same or similar data at the same time. This is an advertisement of the work, because we use the work very, very, we use a lot of elements of the work. And this compound is cerium zirconate. And now cerium is the magnetic ion. It's far from a Heisenberg system. I'm going to explain that in a minute. We looked at the specific heat data. They had data in zero and finite field, and in zero field, let's keep that simple for now, we saw, well, there's no anomaly. There doesn't seem to be any sign of an ordered state. If you look at neutron scattering, don't seem to be any really, you know, there don't seem to be any black peaks. So at least there's no magnetically ordered state. And specific heat is telling us probably there is no ordered state at all. If you look at the excitation spectrum in neutron scattering, energy versus, so now this is the E instead of omega, but it's the same thing. If you look at E versus Q, but that looks very, very diffuse and looks like a continuum of excitations with no real features out there. One must be a little bit careful because the energy scales in this problem are at least a factor of 10, if not smaller, smaller than what we were dealing with in the Heisenberg pyrochlore. And I'm going to explain that in a minute. So yeah, you might be a little bit perturbed by looking at all these dark red points. They are, it could be structural peaks, which you know were subtracted out by doing all sorts of finite temperature subtractions. I won't go into the details. The experimentalists, of course, know a lot more about this. But both groups basically agreed that, yeah, okay, there doesn't seem to be any real magnetic order here. But if you look at this plot, and there is no pinch points, there's no bow ties, there's nothing of that sort which I introduced in the Heisenberg pyrochlore. So where is the, what is so icy about? Where is the ice here? Well, that's the question that bothered us back in 2019 and 20, I would say. But Bruce Rollin offered, and his group offered an analogy, but with spin ice, but the spin ice is dipolar ice. But that's not what is happening. I mean, this system is far from a dipolar ice, which I'm going to explain in a minute. It was an analogy, but without a real Hamiltonian, we cannot do anything meaningful. I mean, I'm one of those people. If I don't see a Hamiltonian, I cannot tell you anything about the system. So I need a Hamiltonian. And that we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the Hamiltonian is. And now the long story short is once you figure out the Hamiltonian, you can answer this question. What is so octopolar about this octopolar ice? And where are those pinch points? The short answer is the pinch points are hidden from our sight. They're there, but they're hidden because of how neutrons, you know, couple to octopoles or how they couple to octopole dipolar systems. So that's going to be my key punch point, punchline. And I have 15 minutes, so I'll do my best. Okay, so we need some sort of cartoon for quantum spin ice. You can say, okay, all these local axes are very intriguing and very difficult to understand. So you can do quote unquote what one of the simplest things, not so simple, but you can look at the Hermele-Fisher balance paper from 2004, which is a really pioneering work. And what they found is that you have the ice constraint. So you have a, let's say, large JG term. Let's forget about local axis, put a global axis. And then you put a small quantum mechanical term. And if you put a small quantum mechanical term and you do third order perturbation theory, you can map this to what is called a ring sort of exchange model. But that ring involves six sites. Once again, those six sites that you're seeing on Tagome are not so unfamiliar. They occur, similar six sites occur on pyrochlores as well. But it turns out that this theory is not exactly solvable. So they what we call rock circumvenalize the Hamiltonian to solve it exactly. And I'll just summarize the key point is that they found that once you add this term, you can actually explicitly write down a wave function, which is a superposition of all ice rule conserving states, except the ice rule now is not two in, two out, it's two up, two down in their picture because they don't have local axes. That's fine, that's okay. But you have a stable phase of matter in three dimensions, which is a U1 spin liquid, which is characterized by gapless excitations, which are photons, and gapful excitations, which are bisons. I'm not going to tell you a whole lot about this because I don't have any evidence of it in numerics, at least right now. But all I want to tell you is that within the theory, the photons are basically gapless. So you should expect some sort of gapless spin liquid. Now, it turns out that if you want to go away from the perturbative regime, you need to do some sort of mean field theory. That seems to be the best game in town we have right now because we don't have, you know, some fancy numeric in 3D, or at least not yet. And this was a direction pioneered, I would say, by the Savary balance paper. But our chair, Professor Kim, has done some seminal works on predicting that this dipolar octopolar system can have what is called as a biflux phase in these octopolar magnets. And I'll explain the octopolar part very quickly in a minute. I would say the work that predates it is also the Huang Chen Hermele paper, which gave us really the Hamiltonian to think about in these particular systems. So what is so particular about these systems? Well, we have to go back to chemistry. There's strong spin orbit coupling. It's a F electron system. The strong spin orbit coupling, F is 3, spin is half, one unpaired electron. So that gives us a splitting of the manifold as of into a 5 half, J equal to 5 half, and J equal to 7 half. Well, that's just single ion physics. And then you have all these surrounding atoms to worry about. That gives you the crystal fields. And that gives you a J equal to 5 half, J equal to MJ equal to plus minus 3 half, or JZ equal to plus minus 3 half. Now that's a Kramer, that's a Kramer's doublet system. It has they're related by time reversal symmetry, but that doesn't look like a familiar spin half at all. Because remember, for spin half, you have to go, if you do S plus, you go from SZ minus half to SZ half. But here you have to go from minus 3 half to plus 3 half. How are you going to go there? You're not going to be able to do it just with J plus. Well, you're going to need J plus cube. You're going to need three actions of J plus to do that, right? So JZ is fine, but J, so you're going to need J plus cube to go from minus 3 half to plus 3 half. That's how octopoles work, that you need some sort of unit of angular momentum 3 to describe this sort of operator, this sort of transition. And one convention that you can choose, and that makes life simple, is that you choose your y-axis a certain way that the y-axis now, I mean the y, tau y, which is the effective spin half degree field. See, we know that we can describe it by some effective spin half, but it's not your conventional spin half. It's not a dipolar spin half. It's a one component of it is an octopole, and it transforms a certain way. Whereas the dipoles, they transform just like vectors, which is like angular momentum. So you need the tau plus to sort of, have this angular momentum 3 degree of freedom, and so that you incorporate the octopolar nature into the y degree of freedom. Anyway, a lot of this analysis is not mine. It was done very originally in these two papers, and the Hamiltonian that they came up with is the so-called XYZ Hamiltonian, where you have to be careful that this XYZ are local spin axes. They are not global spins. You're not talking about global spins. And now you can think of these spins as conventional spin halves. Okay, but it doesn't come for free. If you now look at the Zeeman term, look at how it couples to a magnetic field, it's not your conventional H times a Z. You have to worry about the local component of the magnetic field coupling to the local component of the Z field. And importantly, there is no Y here, because octopoles don't couple to linear, at least to linear order, they do not couple to magnetic field. Yes, they couple to higher order, but they do not couple to linear order. So if you want a sort of minimalistic description, well, there is no Y there. And that's very important. That's very, very important towards what you're seeing in the neutron. Turns out one more level of complication that we needed next nearest neighbor term as well to get agreement with the neutron data. And there's some parallel work by Bruce, which I will also highlight a little later, which also dealt with this Hamiltonian, but they did not include this particular term. But that term is important if you want to get a good description or better description, I would say, of the neutron data. So we also had some tricks up our sleeve, which we just threw at this problem. What else can we do? We basically used the finite temperature Langevin method, which of course was invented much earlier in the 90s. And we had some previous success on other pyrochloride systems and explaining the specific heat of ytterbium titanate and erbium titanate. And we had also good comparison with Singh and Michel Gingras' NLCE data. So we felt pretty confident. More recently, we've been using this technique for intermediate temperature triangular Hubbard model physics and explaining some data at Cornell. So we were pretty confident that, we don't have very big system sizes, but we can still get some idea of what's going on. And even the numerical link cluster, which is a sort of parallel technique, actually works. is of, it works in the thermodynamic limit, sure, but it also has a finite size limitation of a different sort, because you can only go to finite order in beta, but I won't go into that. So anyway, this gentleman, Anish Bhardwaj, my postdoc, took up this challenge and decided, I'm going to figure out the parameters come what may. And this is his effort, primarily his effort. And yeah, we have four parameter sets. We don't expect this to do well, but at low temperature, we have some deviations, fine. The high temperature part actually can be reasonably well described around about 1 Kelvin, which is consistent with what Bruce's group is actually reporting, fine. You go to a higher field, 2 Tesla, it works reasonably well. You don't gain a whole lot. Actually, there are some other issues, but you don't get a whole lot by going to very, very high field, because then you just recover, you should recover at least single ion physics, because the energy scales in this problem are actually very, very small, much smaller than NCNF. And so the scales are reported here. These are our best parameters, but we have three more sets. And the main point is not the numbers, but the main point is that JY, coupling that goes with the tau y, or sy as well. And some people use tau, some people use small s, but it's the same thing, is actually the dominant interaction in our parameter set. We also have a parameter set where jy and jx are comparable, which is sort of consistent with also what Bruce Collin is reporting. But okay, anyway, this is what we find. And we can also fit the G tensor and so on, because we have the magnetic field data. What is most sensitive is the value of jn and n. Small changes in JNN can easily reorganize the spectral weight and different parts of the in momentum space. And so we had to optimize that as well to get the best sort of agreement with the experiment. So we do all of that. And right, so this is, I'm sorry, this is a little bit hidden, but this is our integrated molecular dynamics data. So now we got the Hamiltonian parameters from some combination of SCGA, finite temperature Langshows. Finite temperature Langshows, by the way, is a quantum method. Somebody was asking. But yeah, Michelle has a question. So go ahead, Michelle. Yeah. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yes. I'm wondering, your previous slide, how did you get a, why is GX non-zero?
Yeah, great question. And thank God somebody asked a question. There should be no GX if it's a purely J equal to 5/2, MJ equal to 3/2 system. But you have some coupling with the 7/2 manifold. You have some mixture, admixture with the 7/2, which gives you another contribution, which is the GX tau X term. If you did not have that contribution, you would just get purely GZ SZ term, purely that. So the 7/2 matters. In fact, this was first sort of reported. The mixture, admixture with 7/2 was reported in a different compound, which is cerium stannate, not cerium zirconate. So we allow, we admit for that possibility as well. So that's another funny part of this term. The local HZ couples to the GXSX term. That's the non-trivial part of, which is just comes from this effective projection to the spin half manifold, to this 2-4-2-2 manifold. I'm happy to discuss this further.
So what's the energy scale of the J equals 7/2 manifold?
This splitting is, actually, I don't remember it at the top of my head.
It's about 250 millivolts, actually. We've measured it. Relatively low for rare earths.
Right. So in stannates, it's, I think, even lower, right? So because if you look at the crystal field doublet, it has a lot of admixture of, so I don't know about the zirconate. I'm sorry, I don't know the number at the top.
But this is still a huge energy scale compared to the intrinsic energy scale of the multiples.
I would completely agree with you, except that if I just look at what people did with quantum chemistry, they just got the crystal field wave functions. And you look at the coefficients, they are not like 0.99 and 0.01. They are like 0.87 and 0.46, you know, the relative admixtures. So it's not as small. That's a mystery to me. I would just put it at that. It's a good question. I completely agree with you.
No, but what admixes the state? I mean, the energy scale is still 250 millivolt, right? And so the multiples themselves, right? Or the bare interactions are much smaller than that scale. So there should be very little leakage into the ground state manifold. So do you understand that?
I don't know the answer to that. It's a good question. We just admit for that possibility. So we can allow for GX0, which is one of our parameter sets as well. Maybe we can continue this, Michelle. It's a good question, but I just want to give the main punchline. It's a very good question. It bothers us as well. So anyway, we did the molecular dynamics, same similar technique as what we had in the previous project. And once again, the agreement is at least visually okay. Remember, we are dealing with very, very small energy scales. So in fact, the experimental resolution is comparable to the spread that you are seeing here. These are again two different experimental groups. This is powder average data. This is crystal data. But we looked at another experiment on the StanIt, and in fact, there the resolution seems to be much better. I'm not comparing experimentalists, by the way, but this is what we really found in the literature. This is cerium StanIt. The energy scales seem to be a bit lower and more consistent with what we are finding, but I'm comparing an apple to an orange because, of course, I don't know the Hamiltonian parameters for this one. So one has to be careful. But I want to get to my punchline because I have only a few minutes, but I'm more than happy to stay back. Is that where are the pinch points? I mean, Bruce and others were giving this analogy, but the key point that we are trying to make in our paper is that if you look at the local XX, YY, and ZZ correlators, you will see the pinch points in the YY channel because the octopoles are like your dominant term. They are the ice-like term. But it's not the local XX, YY, and ZZ that matters alone. You have to... what Neutron is measuring is moment-moment correlators, MM correlators, and there's a G-tensor sitting there. And the G-tensor is such that it does not couple, you know, it does not, M does not have any contribution from SY at all, from, you know, because that's what the octopolar, you know, that's what octopoles don't have any contribution in the Neutron signal at all. Of course, they control the energetics. Of course, they control the specific heat, but they don't control what you're seeing here. So you have to put all these, you know, you see the pinch points in the YY channel, but when you put it into what Neutron is measuring, which involves the moment-moment correlator, and the moment is related to, of course, the bare spins, but it's related by G tensor, which is everything in this game, you get what Bruce and Pingqing Dai, Bruce Golin and Pingqing Dai are getting. Then the pinch points go away. Pinch points are hidden from us because of the way neutron scattering works and because of what you're measuring in neutron scattering. So now I get to my punch point, which is that, so now we looked up the mean field phase diagram using something called gauge mean field theory that Yong, Beck, Kim, and others, as I mentioned, basically pursued. And sure enough, if you look at all our parameter sets, they seem to be deep. I think Michelle has his hand. Just give me a minute, sorry. They seem to be deep into the pi flux state. Which is an octopolar quantum spin liquid because now your GY is the dominant sort of octopolar sort of thing. The octopoles are controlling the dominant interactions here. And also, as I said, parallelly, Bruce Collins' group also came up with a similar conclusion. I just want to emphasize that if I have one more minute, that it is in the gauge mean field theory. It is the ring exchange term, the sign of the ring exchange term decides whether you get the pi flux state or the zero flux state. And if you look at the sign of our transverse sort of interactions, which is sort of Jx plus Jz, that has the right sign that has to be positive so that the flux cosine phi has to be minus one, so phi has to be pi. And so it is broadly consistent with what the theorists, people are telling us. But we don't have an independent check that we have found a pi flux state. We are doing some Langevin calculations. We are seeing it's limited technology, but we're seeing evidence that it's gapless, modulo finite size effects. Whereas we know from other experiments on other pyroclores that where we expected a gap, we got a gap, which was the case of ytterbium titanate. You can debate which parameters to use for ytterbium titanate, sure. And so we are playing around with this sort of set of ideas. We can also try to understand something perturbatively, which is what we're doing. We're trying to understand what happens in a magnetic field. You lose a lot of the neutron signal when you put on a magnetic field, in this case, a 001. Once again, we think that's purely due to the octopolar nature of this phase. And okay, I think I'll end there. I wanted to advertise a little bit more, but that's fine. We'll just stop there. And this is the general summary. I'm happy to answer any other questions. But this is the general summary. We've developed some techniques. We've implemented some techniques where we are sort of we've explored two pyrochloride candidates, and they seem to be broadly consistent with the experiment, but there's a lot to be done. So thank you so much. Is that right? I finished in 1 hour? Okay.
Oh, thank you very much.
But I'm happy to get back to the questions that were raised, by Bruce and Michelle and others.
All right, so thank you very much. The talk is now open to questions. Bruce, please go ahead.
Yes, thanks very much for actually a very lovely talk.
Thank you.
I was going to ask you in the first problem that you discussed, you did calculations that were spin polarized. You had a spin flip channel and a non-spin flip channel. Yes. Have you done the same thing for the cerium zirconate?
I haven't, but I can, if that's the question. Yeah, I haven't done it. It's a good question. Yes, we haven't done it.
And the reason I was thinking about it was the non-spin flip channel in classical spin ice, of course, doesn't show the pinch points. It shows the zone boundary scattering. And, it can be useful to isolate the spin flip structure factor, just the way that you're showing here.
I think that is definitely worth exploring. I haven't looked into it carefully, but that is maybe the next direction that we can pursue. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Can I ask? So your simulation is classical simulation, right? Thermodynamic simulation.
Right.
So you have some argument for the
analogy. I did not emphasize it enough, and this is a very important point because otherwise, it's all garbage. Right?
The question is, I'm thinking about the cerium zirconate.
Okay.
You do.
You want me to go there? Okay.
Yeah. So the point is that this is a classical simulation. So you expect that you wouldn't see things like photons and bisons in quantum.
Yeah. So I would not expect it, to be honest. Right.
Most likely, what you see is analogous to, say, spin-on excitations in the quantum spin ice, I would say, if there is any correspondence.
Spin-on excitations in quantum spin ice, what would be the characteristic signature of that?
For example, you have a very high intensity.
Yes.
If you look at your dynamical structure factor.
Correct.
And you have a high intensity, some finite energy. It's like in your space, like 0.05.
Well, both the experiment and theory, by the way, have it. Yeah, there's a this is all squished down to compare that's with right. the experiment. So but really, there is a it's right. not peaked at zero. If that's what you're asking, there is actually a bump.
But that's presumably the scale of like a J sub y.
J sub y is on the scale of. Yeah, a 0.1 MeV. That's right. It's on the scale of J sub y.
So thinking about this connection to.
We can go lower. We are doing some finer grid at lower energy. Absolutely. That's a good point. Yeah, we can do something even smaller than that. And we are still seeing some. Sort of bump. All I'm saying is that it's not peaked at zero, but you have some sort of bump. Okay, I don't think I have the plot here, but I don't have that particular plot here, but there's some sort of bump there. So there's some low intensity at zero energy, and then there's some growth there. So it's close to J sub y, but it's not exactly J sub. Even if you look at the stannate, it's below J y. And now you can ask, okay, how much smaller than JY is it? Is it like half JY and so on? Yeah, it's that answer we do not know right now.
So in this
I want to add one more thing, Yongbek. Maybe this is not so trivial. That JX and JZ are actually not we are not in the perturbative regime. Our parameters are such that we are not the JX and JZ are actually close to, not close, but they're at least the same order of magnitude. Okay, maybe they're a factor of four and so on. So there could be something really non-perturbative going on. I think you're comparing with this sort of Wison and photon sort of picture.
Yes, correct. So I'm not
in the perturbative regime. That can make things really tricky.
It would be renormalized strongly.
Right. So that's why one trick that we are playing with is we're playing with making this part weaker. Right, this sort of, you can say, oh, this is the classical part and this is the quantum mechanical part. And if I make this weaker or stronger, I can sort of, tune between a classical ice and a quantum ice. So that's the game that we are playing with. At least for static correlations, that seems to be giving us, so maybe the pi flux and the zero flux, maybe they're very hard to distinguish from the correlations. Maybe you need energetics. In fact, I intend to look at your paper a little bit more carefully, because you do say that there's a way of distinguishing these two phases, right? Because at least I'm just saying within this particular classical framework with all sorts of correlation functions, we cannot see any clear difference between the perturbative regime and the non-perturbative regime, except that, of course, the numbers are getting renormalized. Of course, that aspect is very important. That cannot be ignored. But whether it is zero flux, pi flux, or whether it is something else, that we cannot be sure, because we don't know. We don't have evidence for photons and Wisons. We just have evidence based on what you and others are telling us, that okay, the parameter regime is somewhere in this.
Sure. We didn't find any phase transition.
Right. So you did some exact diagonalizations as well on small system sizes. But the nice thing is about your phase diagram is that, and our parameters is that we are deep into this so-called phase. Now, we don't know if there's some other phase here. Now, if this was close to the boundary, actually, I wouldn't trust anything. But maybe it's not so unbelievable because we are sort of deep into the phase and all sorts of attempts to fit things with the XYZ Hamiltonian to experimental data seem to be. It is one of those things that without a Hamiltonian, we can't be sure. And I don't know what would be a smoking gun experiment to be like, oh, this is exactly the pi flux state, or what would be the smoking gun numerics? That's something that I'll be happy to discuss, actually.
So my real question was actually in your MD simulation of the
stuff. Yeah.
So you didn't see any gap in the spectrum. It's all continuous all the way.
Looks continuous.
It's continuous all the way to zero energy.
That's a problem, but we need to do some sort of finer grids to be absolutely sure, but maybe even bigger system sizes. This was around 8,000 spins, but that seemed to be the case. Right, and that seems to be the case even for the Stan-8. Well, I don't know what the neutron, the actual resolution is, but we've been talking to Swiss Romain Sybille, and some unconfirmed reports indicate that actually it is all the gapless all the way in the experiment. Now, it's a Stan-8 versus zirconate.
I was just wondering.
It does seem that it's gapless even in the experiment.
I was just wondering what the experimental situation was.
Experimentally, it seems to be the case. In fact, there seems to be some rich structure there. But I don't know. We'll see what there is going on, what's going on there.
Is there a gap?
It's a very small energy scale. Keep that in mind. So even they need to be absolutely sure.
Maybe Bruce can answer this question. But
maybe Bruce can resolve this question for us. I don't know.
I think all the data on both the Stan-8 and the zirconate are consistent with no gap. But to within the resolution. And so all of this data is it's usually based on a temperature subtraction. So that's why you lose information down below about 0.05 MeV or something.
Right.
Because
so there is some intrinsic limitation, but am I right that you can do even lower resolution than that?
You can, but you need to switch over to a different technique. So our data and Pensheng Dai's data, and I think the Sybille data is all time of flight. inelastic, and it's hard to go much beyond what we've done here. But you can go to other techniques like backscattering and neutron spin echo, for example. Although you know they have their own strengths and weaknesses.
Of course. Right. So yeah, that question I cannot answer, but I'll be interested to see the data.
But I think that the gap should gap is presumably smaller than 0.05.
There's something. It has just.
I think Heyang is a
0.05.
Can I ask some simple questions?
Yeah, sure.
Questions. One is this might be related to the neutron. So one is you said that the neutron doesn't couple to octapolar moment.
Yeah, well,
it breaks the time reversal. So octapole produce the magnetic field, different distribution from dipole. So when neutron comes in, it will see the internal magnetic field. So in principle, it couples. It can be
but only, but not to linear order. That's what I meant. It couples to higher order. Yeah, that's all does. I meant. So I should have qualified that. Maybe
it does couple to higher order as well as probably the form factor of 1 minus q q divided by q square is coming from dipole-dipole interaction. So it'll be different, but it does couple. And another question.
But look, now you can clarify the confusion for me. Look, this is the, you would agree that this is the Zeeman term, right? So the Zeeman term is this funny term.
Yes. Yeah.
It has this magnetic moment, which does not have any mention of tau y at all.
So, I know, but your JY is largest here.
So. Yeah, I understand. And JY controls the energetics, I understand. Mm-hmm. But all I'm saying is that if you look at this magnetic moment, you just plug it into this, into linear order, if you just plug it into this expression.
Up to the linear order, I agree. Yeah, but you have
So that's all I'm saying. So you are right that to higher order, that should exist maybe somewhere. Maybe it's all buried under some diffuse thing. I don't know.
I don't know if that actually affects your pinch point because you say about something about pinch point. If you only look at only that difference, then that small cubic terms might affect. One question.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but all I'm saying is that this characteristic pinch point, which you see for the local correlations, of course, you have to go to the global basis. That was my main point. Mm-hmm. So maybe Bruce's analogy is not so crazy, although he did it for dipolar systems. Mm-hmm. But where was this? Yeah, so he sees this sort of feature, right? I mean, you're saying that this feature could be this feature, which sort of still survives. That could be true. I'm not disagreeing with that. All I'm saying is that we cannot use a dipolar sort of system and sort of argue something for an octopolar system. And that's where we came in. And that was my main selling point, I would say. Mm-hmm. So I would agree with you that maybe this has some origin, which is of similar character. I don't know. I have to think about it some more.
And my second simple question is there a mu SL on this?
Based on what?
Mu SL on this system, muon spin.
USL on this system.
Muon spectroscope.
Oh, muon. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know if there is any data out there. I actually am not an expert in that particular technique. So I actually do, and I do not know if there is any data for USR.
Bruce, do you know if there is?
Bruce could know. Yeah, I actually don't know.
Yes, but there isn't analyzed and understood data on USR. the signal is not so easy to understand. So we're working on this with my colleague Graham Luke.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, looking forward to it then.
Yeah. So none of your questions are simple, by the way. You said you have two simple questions, but none of them were that simple. It took us time to figure those things. I mean, at least the first thing out. Anyway, yeah.
So, okay, thank you.
Yeah, most welcome. Bruce has his hand
raised. Bruce has a question.
That is just...
Yeah, so I was going to ask a very similar question to what I asked about the spin one pyrochlore, which is that all of these cerium systems have a little bit of disorder in them. That's very hard to control experimentally, and so in our samples, you have a little bit of cerium 4+, which is unusual for a rare earth system. Mostly the only oxidation state that's stable is 3+. So you don't have to worry about this. But for the very light rare earths, that's not true. And so there could be and probably are magnetic vacancies at the level of a few percent. And do you have a sense for how sensitive any of your conclusions would be?
Yeah, actually, I'm really glad you brought it up because this has been bothering me. Maybe somebody else, somebody can, and maybe you can bother it because we did speak to your student, Jonathan Goddard. Yeah. And look, this is the thing that is bothering me the most. You go to high field, you should just get back single ion physics. And yet at low temperature, there is still some discrepancy with the data. And no matter which model we try, we just tried like four models and maybe you have some parallel conclusion on that. I'm not sure, I have to read your paper more carefully, but I cannot describe this high field data accurately. Now that could be because there is some suppression through vacancies and et cetera that I not modeled in my, you know, small, you know, pyroclot. That could be one possibility at low temperature. At high temperature, that doesn't seem to be the case, but this is a little bit of cheating because you have to go to higher, even higher fields to be absolutely sure that this is not, you know, that this kind of discrepancy is not there. Now, one thing we thought about is that this is all this effective spin half business. Maybe you have all these higher order couplings. So Youngbeck and Adarsh Patri have this paper where they do the H cube term. But for 111, H cube doesn't matter. So then the next natural question is, oh, is there an H to the power, whatever, 5 term or whatever to model this? I don't know. That did not seem so appealing to me. So this is some puzzle that is bothering us. It is far from resolved. Low field is fine. In fact, you see this in the specific heat as well. The specific heat is poorly described by the Langevin data. And you would think, oh, single ion physics, the simplest thing to describe, and yet you cannot do it. So I bothered Roderick, I bothered many people, but I don't think anyone knows the answer. So if you know the answer, that would be great. Maybe it's the vacancy stuff that you were talking about. I don't know. But it's a few percent discrepancy. It's there. It's like 8%, 10%, but it's there. It's not like it's not there. This is my this is our first attempt at the problem. So I think we'll discover a lot more, I guess. But that is certainly a problem, Bruce. And I do not know how to model that. Or even, you know, maybe I could come up with some rough estimate just based on this sort of discrepancy.
Right. Yeah. No, I was just wondering. I mean,
non-magnetic ions would suppress this. I think that estimate would tell me that it would be around 8% or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think experimentally, it is clear that it's very hard to get this material completely stoichiometric, completely in, you know, so, with all the cerium 3+. But, you know, that's you know, yeah. you can't get that's rid of this any material, really.
Right. That's true of any material. That's true. Yeah. In the case of sodium calcium, yeah, there is charge disorder because you have Na+ and Ca2+. But it, just in terms of the, yeah, I mean, other than this glassiness, which could be a serious issue, then the question is, why are we seeing these pinch points, and you know, why are we seeing this continuum? Yeah, maybe we are seeing sort of coexistence of different domains of things. That's completely possible. It's not ruled out. Maybe we don't have any superposition there. That's why we as a community need to think seriously about, you know, what is the sort of spin one. Pyrochlore, quantum theory of it. We don't know that yet. We have all these hunches based on these AKRT loops and so on. Nothing definitive there. Yeah. So we'll find out, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Well, if you don't mind, maybe I can ask you.
Yeah, sure. You can ask me as many as you want.
So one of your promising parameter set.
What is the promising parameter? What do I mean? Yeah, okay. I'm really thankful for that question. I think it relates to Michelle's question as well. Because yes, we were also bothered by this GX being large because it's symmetry allowed if you allow this coupling to 7.5. And for the stannate, you see large admixture. But for zirconate, we didn't know the crystal field wave function. So we still allowed for GX. Now,
No. Actually, that's not my question.
Oh, that's not your question. Sorry.
Yeah, my question was in one of the you had this phase diagram and
phase diagram points. And we put right points. Yeah.
Here, okay. So there is this one that
is a bit of an outlier.
Exactly. I think that's close to Proust parameters too, right?
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because we constrained gx to be zero then, which is the equivalent of their theta equal to zero in this different language where you do this transformation. So we impose gx equal to zero there, which would be consistent with what Michel is telling us. And then jx and jy become actually comparable in that regime. So we don't want to rule it out, right? It's there. That makes quote-unquote physical sense. But these other sets were allowing for gx. And when you allow for non-zero gx, the most natural solution was the one where jy was greater than gx. So we don't want to discount Bruce's possibility. Yeah, we are also finding that set because we did this optimization under different conditions. Now you can say, okay, you know, it's only a few parameters, but also the techniques are, and the theory is limited and the fitting is limited because, you know, you're using finite temperature lanches on numerical link cluster, not fitting the low temperature part. So one has to take that with a pinch of salt, but we do allow, admit for that possibility. And yes, that parameter set matches with Bruce's. But these ones, I believe they did not allow for because they did not get a GX. I think they did not put a GX. I could be wrong. Maybe Bruce can clarify, but they
That's correct.
So they did not get GY greater than GX. So you're right. If this is the correct set and these three are garbage, well, then, okay. Then we have to sort of think of a more renormalized version of the spinized theory, because then there is no dominant scale. Then there are two scales that are important, the octopole and the dipole, JX and JY, both are important. You know, in that theory, you know, JX by JY ratio is one and JZ is the small parameter. So then we need a highly renormalized theory of the spinized. There's no sort of, we shouldn't expect some adiabatic sort of continuity to some sort of ice manifold. So I don't know how to think about that parameter set in this ice language necessarily, but it's a possibility. It's consistent with the data. We are also finding it.
So they are like at the classical level, the dominant correlation state 2 in 12?
Wait, are you asking me or telling me this? For Jx equal to Jy?
Yeah, for example.
You're asking me what is the classical state there?
Right. At the classical level,
yeah.
Question is the dominant spin correlation still ice manifold? That's the question.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. Right? I would want to think some more, but I don't know the answer right now.
Yeah.
Possible. Yeah.
So that's
some. I mean, we are basically a bit too tied to the ice theory, so yeah. But it's possible that there's something. Maybe there could be something outside the ice manifold. Is that what you're saying? There.
No. I'm
guessing it's within the ice manifold.
It
itself.
Just bothers me at some conceptual level, because all this story really comes from starting from the ice manifold.
Yeah, I understand. I completely agree with
and
you.
And if you're far away from that, then question
so,
is
right. So that's why we did the quantum mechanical calculation, because we are also bothered by that. But look, there is ice here. So look, what am I doing here? Let me just say that very clearly. I have some dominant term. Okay, but this is for the parameter set, which is not Bruce's parameter set. Okay, this is one of these three. Okay, so we can redo this for Bruce's, for the set that we both agree on, which is JX equal to, we haven't done it. But you're right that for the set that we do have, we are adiabatically, I wouldn't call it adiabatically, but we see that there's a separation between ice and monopole in the ED. So there's no cheating here. It's quantum. Right. And so when we change this quantum parameter, then we have this monopole sort of come down and ice sort of starts to split. Of course, it's a finite system. Take it with a pinch of salt. But this stays somewhat gapless. Whereas in the ferromagnetic case, you have order by disorder. You have a selection of six ferromagnetic states, Balanz and Savary, and many others actually realize this perturbatively. You get that. In second order perturbation theory. So, you get a fair amount. So these results are consistent with gapless versus gap. But yeah, if I change the parameter set and redo this, I don't know the answer, Yongbek. And I'll have to think some more and I'll get back to you, I guess. I don't know the answer. Yeah.
I was just curious.
Yeah, I don't know the answer.
So, Kapoor says another question.
Kapoor says another question. Okay.
Yeah, so while we've got
No problem. It's okay. I also have as many questions as you have.
Well, so this is not really connected to your talk, but I was going to ask you for your impression on the Sibille neutron work on cerium stannate, in which they report diffuse energy integrated diffuse scattering, which basically only seems to show up in the octopolar channel at high Q, and at low Q they measure almost nothing. And so my read of this is that if they had single crystal cerium stannate, which they don't, they would see something very different from what we see in cerium zirconate. Is that correct?
High Q as in how high Q? I'm just trying to understand. I'm just trying to wrap my head around whether we have... Because we just restrict ourselves to some sort of brilliant zone, but I'm just curious, do they go to even bigger zones, or is that... I have not looked at that data, so I have to... I'm just thinking out loud. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they have measurements which go out to 10 inverse angstroms.
Okay.
Huge. Right. And it appears that they're not measuring anything like dipolar stennis, and they make the argument that they are measuring the octopolar they're measuring the octopolar.
Right. So this is, I think, in the 2020 paper, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
it looks right. Like there's dotted points, etc.
Yeah,
I don't have a strong opinion of it, Bruce. I'll be completely honest. It's something that I would have to maybe try to do the calculation first to get some intuition for what is happening and whether that is consistent. But you're saying they don't see any dipolar correlations at all?
Well, there's very little. I mean, if you look at one of the plots in that paper, yeah. In principle, I could even put up here.
I can stop my share.
if I could share, I might be able to.
Yeah, oh, sure. Okay.
I'm not sure. Oh no, I've got to be permitted to share, actually. Let's see. Hold on just a second. No. So Young Back, I think you've got to do something to maybe to make me a co-host or something like that.
Now you can share.
Okay. Oh, I'm the host.
No, this will work.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you can see this. This is their paper.
Yeah, I can see this. Yeah. So I have seen this particular plot, but I never internalized it, to be completely honest. Go ahead. Why don't you go ahead? Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, this kind of confuses me in that if from this, it looks like they're seeing the octopolar structure factor due to octopolar spin ice. So that's this structure factor, powder averaged. And they don't see any of this structure factor, which is dipolar spin ice.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And because they're not seeing any diffuse scattering or very little diffuse scattering at low Q, but they are seeing lots of diffuse scattering at high Q, I think that means that cerium stannate would look very different from cerium zirconate.
Possibly, because when I made that argument about taking these local correlation functions and putting it into to neutron, I mean, there was a dipolar component, which is not zero. I mean, it's
right.
Yeah, right. So I would imagine some, yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, it could be that stannate is different. I will have to think more about
okay,
it.
Okay. Yeah.
I know the answer, unfortunately. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just thought
every material seems to be like its own standard model, right? Its own parameters, own.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I thought, as I had you here and on the spot, I could ask you.
No. Yeah, that's great. But I'm more than happy to think some more and chat with you about this.
Sure.
I have not. Yeah. I've not thought deeply. But thank you for the question. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Paul.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's an honor.
Discussions. And, we always promise that this talk is not going to last more than 1 hour and 30 minutes.
1 hour, 30 minutes, yeah.
I think we reached the limit. So yes. I think that there are more questions, but maybe.
Sure, I'm happy to be back in.
I think you can contact Hiteshi for more questions.
Yeah, I have a website. I have a website which I made 3 years ago. So
I'm
now visible.
Okay, yep, so thank you so much.
Everyone is strong and
to Hiteshi and also.
Thanks, Hiteshi.
Yeah.
No problem, John. Thank you. Yeah, most welcome.
Okay. Okay. Thanks a lot.